Blog Talk Radio.
It is a beautiful, beautiful spring day here in Fairfax, Virginia, the kind that we dreamed of just weeks ago when the snow and the ice were still overhead. This is Military Monday on the Right Stream Network, and I am your host, John Gresham. I want to thank you for joining us today. We're going to have a little fun today. We're going to do one of those little stories that I love to tell so much. A small story in some people's mind, but a big one in terms of its effect. People know that the United States Navy's been around for a few hundred years, even predating the actual Declaration of Independence on July 4, 1776. But like all institutions, the United States Navy has had its high points and low points. And right now, as we go through one of those periods which could theoretically be considered a low point, it's worth going back, 100 years or so, and looking at the period after the American Civil War. This period, during the late 19th century, saw the United States Navy in many ways at its lowest point after its creation, even more so than the period after the Revolution, before we built the big frigates that were authorized under the Jefferson administration. We're going to talk today to a gentleman, a naval officer and history instructor at the Naval Academy, Commander James, he prefers us to call him Chris, so we will, Renfro. Commander Renfro has gone and produced a book based upon his graduate thesis called Home Squadron, which covers the period between the Civil War and the Spanish-American War, more specifically a developmental renaissance that appeared between 1874 and the middle of the last decade of the 19th century. And without further ado, we're going to go ahead, and if the button works, we're going to say, hello, Commander.
Hi, John. Good to be with you.
How you doing today, Chris?
Great.
Got all the exams and all the kids taken care of over there at the Baltimore Boys and Girls Boat School?
Not even close. Maybe a third of my exams graded.
Well, it's a start. And I guess my first question is, okay, what's your background and why did you become a history teacher and write history books? What was the career path that brought you to this point?
So my background is as a carrier aviator. I spent about 15 years at sea. I'm a EA-6B electronic countermeasures officer or a weapon system officer on the EA-6B Prowler. And I did that until I essentially got too old for flying anymore, and it was I was at a point in my career when it was time for me to look around for something else to do that was tied a little bit closer to a desk in the ground. And so I was very, very fortunate to be selected for a very small community within the Navy called the Permanent Military Professor Community. And it is exactly what the name sounds like. The Navy sends you to graduate school. You pick up a PhD in whatever field it is that you're studying, and then you report to the Naval Academy as a permanent faculty member. So I've been here since 2012 and really enjoying it.
What's it like to be out there among those young officers knowing that what you're looking at with each one of them is a piece of still wet clay that you can mold and make different and maybe even better with your actions?
Well, that would certainly be the idea, right? And it is I teach a lot of freshmen because I teach the Naval History course, and we, among others, and we give that course to the incoming freshmen. So I get to see them when they're young and brand new and impressionable, and I'm always really impressed when I see them again in my upper level offerings, so I see them as juniors and seniors, the amount of maturing that takes place in those two or three years is really incredible.
Now, my understanding from our earlier talk is that your book, Home Squadron, put out by U.S. Naval Institute Press, had its origins in one of your graduate theses, correct?
Yes, that's correct. It essentially is based upon the research that I did for my dissertation.
And tell me that little story about going into your graduate advisor and figuring out this is where you wanted to go and the subject you wanted to work on.
Well, this is essentially a road that every graduate student goes down. So you start big, and eventually with the help of a good advisor, and Dr. John T. Sumita at the University of Maryland is certainly a good advisor, with their assistance you sort of work it down to something that you're interested in doing research about. So, you know, in my case, I kind of walked in and said I was interested in studying naval history, and John kind of laughed and was kind enough to indulge me for a while and said, well, that's great. You know, what sort of naval history are you interested in? It's a couple thousand years worth of material to study. And to make a very long story short, eventually I ended up figuring out that I was interested in the late 19th century United States, and that led me to an interest in the development of the late 19th century Navy.
Now, let it be said that while this subject has been examined, it's not what we would call near as favorably looked upon in the community as, say, trying to figure out the angles that Dick Best used to take out the Akagi and the Hiryu on the 4th of June 1942. I mean, you were going into an area where there was still some very fertile ground to be explored and thought through by comparison to most naval historians.
Yes, absolutely. And, of course, you know, therein lies the rub for primary source research is you want to try to do something that other people aren't doing. So in my case, since I'm bracketed by two fairly well-known wars, obviously the Civil War has been done, the Spanish-American War to a lesser extent, but still has been done plenty. And I managed to sort of find an area to write about that gets its share of press for different reasons. But no one has, or at least not recently, has really tackled the operating story.
Okay. And that said, we'll come back and talk a little more about your adventures when you actually got new, you know, you figured out you wanted to make this thesis into a book. But let's go ahead and talk a little bit about the story, because we're talking about the United States Navy, which to most Americans these days, if you look at a new Navy ship coming out into service, be it the Ford or one of the new LPD-17s or an Arleigh Burke, or even for that matter some of the amphibs, other amphibs, these are stealthy-looking, state-of-the-art, missile-armed, high-tech ships. And, you know, there's a certain institutional pride that Americans take in their Navy. In fact, this has been true for a long time. But what was the Navy after the Civil War like? Talk a little bit about the years after the Civil War up through this moment that you kind of start your story with in 1874.
All right, so I think that the first important thing to keep in mind is, you know, what is important to the nation at any given time, because that's what the nation's willing to spend their money on. So if we think about the period of time after the Civil War, the things that everybody is thinking about is, number one, Reconstruction, which is a gigantic explosion of the size of the federal government, and it's expensive, and it is taking a lot of time and energy of all the politicians. We're thinking about westward expansion. So you've got railroads going across, and you've got to deal with the Native Americans and that sort of thing. And we're thinking about the fact that the economy is in the toilet, which is just like sort of any other post-war time when all of a sudden the government orders dry up and people have to – we discharge millions of young men back into the workforce, and we're trying to figure out what to do with all these people. So this is not a period of time that the nation is very interested in anything outside its borders. And we can see that reflected immediately in the state of the U.S. Navy at this time. It's just, for better or for worse, it's not something anyone, any politician is willing to spend any money on. So we have a Navy.
Not unlike right now.
Well, sure, possibly. But, But what we have here is we have a Navy that's very well suited to do exactly what its public wants it to do. And what its public wants it to do is sort of troll around from port to port, showing the flag and sort of apparently, you know, assuring U.S. businessmen who might be in country that there is some sort of small American presence that will protect them if they have issues with the natives. And we're interested in having this alleged ability to do commerce raiding, that this is kind of the naval strategy of the 1870s. And so what we see is we see a bunch of wooden cruisers with auxiliary steam power, perfectly suited for doing that mission, but really not much else.
So, and most of the Navy is leftovers from the big building time of the Civil War, which, by the way, was not a Navy built with an emphasis on quality assurance or longevity.
No, exactly. People get very fooled by the numbers. Oh, my God, there were 700 ships in the Navy at the end of the Civil War. Sure. But if you break that down,
it's the kind of number that would make John Lehman very happy.
Yes, I was a midshipman during the push for the 600-ship Navy, so I remember all of that. And being told
Except
how I was going to fly
ships,
the A-12.
What we would call warships.
Right. So, of all these ships that are built for the Civil War, a vast number of them are gunboats that are extremely effective on the Mississippi, but not for much else. Some of them are monitors, most famously the Monitor versus the CSS Virginia, and we all know about that. Those are wonderful ships for the express purpose of what they're built for and not really much else. And only a very few are the kind of long-range blue water Navy ships that you would need to go out and go cruising. But the problem with that is they're built quickly, they're built with unseasoned wood, and so by the time you're rolling into the late 1860s, early 1870s, they're all rotting. So what we really have effectively is we have available the combat power of, depending on how you like to count the numbers in the annual reports, we have effective combat power available of something in the range of 30 to 35 ships. And these are all, you know, wooden cruising vessels.
And this is for a nation that literally spans an entire continent from sea to shining sea and has growing shoulders. And
right.
And though we don't know it, we need a bigger Navy, probably. So we roll into the 1870s. Nobody's been terribly obnoxious to us, and we've been strikingly well-behaved for a young nation. And then in 1874, what happens?
Well, in 1874, we've got trouble in Cuba. And one of the things that we have to remember is that Americans have been fascinated with the island of Cuba ever since the days of the Founding Fathers. And depending on which side of the political spectrum that you were on, you were interested in Cuba for various reasons, whether it was business interests in the North or a venue to expand the institution of slavery in the South. But anyway, in any event, it's something that we've always had our eyes on, and the post-Civil War era is no different. Now, meanwhile, the Cubanos themselves are interested in throwing off the Spanish colonial rule, and they make several attempts to do this. We are probably most familiar with the final attempt in the late 1890s to do it, because that's the one that's successful with our help. But there are other attempts in the 19th century, and the events in 1873, 1874 are basically a part of this. So the Cubans are rebelling, the Spanish are trying to put the revolution down, and to make a long story short, what you have is essentially a shipload full of unemployed Civil War vet/soldiers of fortune who are running guns and arms and ammunition and people to the Cuban insurgents. The name of this particular ship is the USS, or it's not USS, it's not a military ship, is the SS Virginius. And Virginius is an ex-Confederate blockade runner, so she's one of these ships that the South built specifically to run the blockade, powerful engines, kind of sits low to the waterline, pretty fast, and she's gun-running to the Cuban rebels and flying an American flag while she does it, and eventually her luck runs out and she is captured by the Spanish Navy. Now, all of that that I've described so far would be pretty much not be a terribly big deal, and in fact, it's not taken much notice of within the United States. But the problem is the Spanish, who are getting tired of this kind of behavior, start executing the ship's crew and the soldiers of fortune who was on board, and they execute about 50 of them. I think 54 is the exact number. And including the captain, who was a guy who was a U.S. Naval Academy graduate and a Confederate Navy officer. And so when this happens, this, of course, starts some political tension because Virginius, for better or for worse, was flying a U.S. flag. And the Spanish have now captured U.S. citizens and executed them as essentially war criminals. So now in late 1873, we have a problem.
And what... Describe that problem, and what was the reaction of the U.S. to that problem at that point?
So we essentially think that we're going to end up going to war with Spain. Now, you know, it's as we view this story, one of the things that we as Americans tend to do is view things through the lens of stuff that we already know about history, right? So we know that this story plays out again in 1898, and that we do go to war with Spain, and that we thrash Spain decisively at that time. But we've got to project ourselves back into the 1870s, and it would not have been nearly as easy a nut to crack as it was in 1898. We simply don't have the resources to do it. And so there begins to be this concern that we're going to go to war with Spain, so the Secretary of the Navy is told, okay, get your fleet together. Now, one of the things in passing, that, and I think we're going to come to this later, but one of the things that in passing that I would point out is that this is the exact opposite of what the stated naval strategy is. Right? The naval strategy is we're going to do coastal defense. We've got this series of forts, like, you know, for instance, Fort McHenry. We've got this series of forts that are going to protect the coastline, and then we're going to send our merchant cruisers out to do commerce raiding and basically conduct guerre de course or commerce raiding against the enemy. That's what we've told Congress and the American public that we're going to do if we have a war. So what do we do when we think we're going to go to war with Spain? We bring all of our ships home, we marshal them together in some kind of fleet, which is exactly what we haven't said that we were going to do. So that's one of the questions that I sort of opened my book with. You know, why is it that we've got a strategy that says one thing, but yet in operational practice, we're doing something else?
I'm shocked. Shocked to hear that the strategy doesn't match up with the resources.
Well, certainly. So,
how could such a thing happen? And in the United States, good God.
So what we eventually
just a little bit sanctimonious.
Well, you know, I suppose that's your place to do that. But
yes, it is. It's my show, so go for it. And explain how they go and do the gathering of ships.
Okay, so the good news is that the political thing blows over. Spain, not terribly interested in going to war in late 1873. Neither are we, because unlike the fact that we were extremely interested in going to war in 1898, we're not really prepared to. So the Spanish apologize. I think there's something on the order of $80,000 exchanges hands between the Spaniards and the various families, and that blows over. So we're done with the political side. But now the Navy says to itself, well, we have all these ships gathered from all over the globe here in Key West. Perhaps we ought to be doing some sort of exercise. And what you get in January and February of 1874 is a series of exercises with a dozen wooden cruising ships that you got to remember, they're steam plants. They have steam plants, but the steam plants are auxiliary power. So they're really only meant to be lit off like when you're pulling into port or have bad wind or something like that. They're not primarily intended to be the only method of propulsion for the ship. We gather all these things up in formation, and we start driving around practicing fleet formations like they do over in Europe during this time, and practicing how we would turn together and bring our weapon systems to bear together and that sort of thing against an opposing enemy fleet. And the results are exactly what you might think the results would be by listening to my description of it.
It does not go well.
Well, number one, it takes several days just to figure out the skill set involved to be able to drive these ships so closely together. And one of the things, I think I point this out in the book, is, you know, we naval officers today learn to drive their ships in very close company, and it's extremely difficult to do. And we have a lot of very sophisticated systems and stuff that's feeding us information literally in real time, and the bridge is full of people that are looking over everyone else's shoulders, and it's still hard to do. And so if you take yourself back in time to 1874, and there's no instrumentation whatsoever at all, and you're standing on the bridge of this wooden ship with this gigantic two-man steering wheel, and you're trying to drive in close formation with another ship, I mean, you can see where this is going. But even beyond that, the top speed
the
of the formation...
The propulsion systems were either all the way on or all the way off. There weren't much in the way of throttles.
Pretty much. They could yell down to the engine room to open the valve a little bit more or close it a little bit less, but that's really about as much as they could do. The top speed of the formation is about 4 knots, and that's, they're limited by the slowest ship in the formation. So speed is everything in a fleet fight. I mean, if you talk about Jutland or Tsushima or any of these sort of big fleet battles where the one side crosses the other side's T, crossing the T, if you will, is all about speed. And so driving a formation around at 4 knots is practically useless other than to provide target practice for whoever it is that you're driving the formation against.
By the way, this is about the speed a teenage girl walks in a mall with bags in both hands.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not to go and put too fine a point on it.
Right. Right. So the exercises get carried out. The admiral, the guy that they choose to lead the exercises, by the way, is named A. Ludlow Case, and he was the commander-in-chief of the European station. He came over from the European station. He's put in charge of this kind of conglomeration of ships, and he puts out a letter telling everybody what a great job they'd done and that sort of thing as they disband the fleet. But the reality is that there's a lot of room for growth, and this exercise really makes this readily apparent to certainly the political leaders, certainly the Navy, and maybe to a lesser extent, even to the extent that they knew anything about it, the American public.
And it's worth saying that the American public got most of their news regarding the Navy out of the social registry of the New York newspapers, as you pointed out the other day.
Right. So the movements of the Navy are followed, and this is, it's a little bit difficult for us to relate to in the 21st century, but this is an era where, to be an officer in the Navy was to be one of the higher members of society sort of thing. So these are the sorts of things that were tracked in the society pages. And the coming and going of ships and what they were doing is actually something that would have a column on the first or certainly the second page of the New York newspapers every day. So this stuff is certainly showing up in the mass media.
Okay, so it's clearly obvious the Navy needs help. They need to grow. They need to modernize. They also need to professionalize. And what happens when the new president, President Garfield, takes over?
Well, the first thing that you can say about the 1880s is that we have money. We have a surplus for the first time in several years. So there's lots of things that when we start talking about this kind of change or this, it's been referred to as the Naval Revolution. What are the things that lay the groundwork for that? And this is one of the things I make my students write an essay about during, I think it's their midterm that they get an essay on this, but. So the 1880s, we've got a surplus. There is actually money to be spent. Reconstruction is over. Reconstruction ends in 1877, so we're done with that. We've driven the gold spike at Promontory, Utah in 1869, and the transcontinental railroads, we're sort of done railroading for a while, which what that means to you and me is we've got steel available to do something with. The atmosphere and the time and the financial situation and all these things are right for a president to show up that takes some interest in external matters. And that arrives in the person of James A. Garfield in 1881, Republican administration. And Garfield appoints as his Secretary of the Navy a guy named William H. Hunt, and Hunt is a pro-Big Navy, what they refer to as a navalist. So in other words, an early adherent. Now remember, we're talking 1881 here, so Mahan's book hits the streets in 1890, so we're still a decade out from Mahan. But Hunt is one of these very early adherents to the stuff that Mahan would later make more famous with his big famous book. So you get these people in place, and what we get in 1881 is the first Naval Advisory Board. And what the first Naval Advisory Board is, the importance of this process is that this is really the first time that the Navy sits down with pen and paper and tries to come up, okay, these are our requirements. This is the resources that we would need in order to meet these requirements. What would this look like? So in other words, what you and I call today strategy. And we're all very familiar with, you know, we have a national security strategy, and then we have a national military strategy, and then the Navy takes that and we write a naval strategy, and we have all these layers of bureaucracy in the 21st century that we're kind of familiar with. But what if none of that existed, which is what the 1880s were? So the Naval Advisory Board is the first attempt to really lay before Congress an actual spending program. Hey, this is what you guys want us to do. This is the money we would need to do this. These are the ships we want to build.
Now, of course, there was a minor hiccup there at Union Station just a few months into the Garfield administration, which was that a lunatic went and shot him to death.
Right. So Garfield is out, and Chester A. Arthur is in. And you know, Garfield and Arthur were from two different branches of the Republican Party, and so Arthur was what's referred to as a stalwart. And so basically, not that any of that has much to do with our story, other than to say that when Arthur comes in, he cleans out Garfield's appointees and puts his own in there because he's got to reward all the sort of the stalwart branch of the Republican Party. He's got to give them all jobs. So William H. Hunt is out, and a guy named Chandler, Secretary of the Navy Chandler, is in. And what Chandler does is he takes the results of the first Naval Advisory Board, which I have to say we're kind of all over the place, because the first Naval Advisory Board, other than the fact that they were folks trying to do something for the first time, which is difficult enough as it is, they had a couple of problems with the report that they eventually released. The first problem was that they, I suppose not unlike what happens today sometimes, the first Naval Advisory Board asks for the moon. They come up with a list of, I think it's, they need 68 new ships. You know, well, what's the inference there? The inference is that the administration's been underfunding their Navy and not doing their job, right? So the administration wasn't terribly thrilled with that. But even beyond this gigantic number of ships that they asked for that they could never get through Congress if they wanted to, there was a disagreement about what kind of ships. And here you see the famous split between the line and the engineers in the late 19th century Navy, because the line officer said, well, we want this kind of ship. They need to be steel. They need to have these capabilities. And the engineers said, no, we need this kind of ship. They need to be made of iron, not steel, because we don't have a steel-producing capability, and they need this, that, and the other thing. And without getting into all that, essentially the report of the Naval Advisory Board of 1881 is actually two reports. It's a majority report signed by the line officers, and it's a minority report signed by the engineering officers. And so what am I saying? It's all over the place.
People disagreeing over little things like propulsion and materials and technology. How could that ever happen today?
Well, and, you know, again, I have to hand it to these guys that are literally making this stuff up as they go. And I don't know, I guess one would hope in the 21st century that we at least had a process down, but I suppose that doesn't always work out that way. But
not so much. but please, you're telling a great story here. Go for it.
So, well, we end up
so basically James A. Garfield getting popped actually winds up working out better for the Navy in the long term.
Well, as a historian, I might be out on a limb if I agreed with that. But
I know that as a serving line officer, you're not supposed to be advocating the assassination of politicians.
Why don't we not do that? I will say certainly Chandler is the right guy at the right time. How's that? And there was some concern because you know, William H. Hunt was a known big Navy kind of supporter, and when Hunt's out, there's some concern. And Chandler, I think, is a journalist. He doesn't really have the kind of background.
Yeah, and he's actually related to the family, I believe, that eventually wound up owning the L.A. Times for later on.
Yeah, so, well, there, I didn't know that.
There's
some concern, but Chandler ends up really being the right guy to get a program through Congress at the right time, and so it does play out. He appoints a board to basically go in and clean up the mess that the first Naval Advisory Board made, and they do, and there's another, I mean, there's sort of a long story involved with that, but what we end up with is we go to Congress asking for what turns out to eventually be what we refer to as the ABCD ships, so the first four steel ships of the new steel Navy, and funds for those are authorized in 1883.
And what kind of ships are these? I mean, I know your story in your book is more about people and culture and societal development, but talk a little bit about these ships, because what happens to them and what gets done with them is important.
Well, they're interesting because if you look at the ships, then you can sort of see this story I'm telling about the development of naval, you know, operational doctrine. And because they're essentially billed as cruisers. Okay, so what does a cruiser do? A cruiser goes out, it looks for enemy merchant shipping, and it preys on them. It has a very limited ability to engage other ships, typically ships that are lesser armed than they are, and they do presence missions and those sorts of things, but they are not ships that are designed to enter into line combat with peer naval competitors. Okay, so that the ABCD ships are not armored. They are made of steel, but they're not armored. Okay, so they're not really intended to stand in a battle line and be shot at with large caliber naval guns. They also have full sail rigs. So they have their power plants are not the latest technology. They're certainly better than what the wooden cruisers had, but they're not the latest technology that the Europeans have. They're not particularly good engines. They are expected to drive around with their sails and use sail power whenever they can. They are fully electrified. They do have double hulls. So, I mean, they're an interesting contrast of sort of the old and the new. We've got some good new technology, but yet they are still ships that are designed and are marketed, I might add, to Congress and the public for the express purpose of being cruisers. Show the flag, prey on enemy shipping. And, of course, what I talk about in my book is that this is exactly how they're not used when they get to the fleet.
And when they get to the fleet, what happens to them, and how does the Navy choose to use them?
Well, when I ask my students when I'm talking about this, I explain what these ships did, and then I say, all right, you guys tell me. So I've just talked to you about these cruising, these ships and how they've been designed and how they've been built, and you tell me how they would be utilized. And eventually I'll get one or two students that'll say, well, I would think that they would go out on cruising missions like the old wooden ships did. They'd go from port to port and show the flag and do this kind of thing. And this is exactly what the Navy doesn't do with them. The Navy forms these ships into a squadron. It's referred to as the Squadron of Evolution or the White Squadron, depending on what source you're reading. And they place them under the command of an admiral named John Grimes Walker. And Admiral Walker spends the next 3 years taking the squadron around, first to Europe and then to various places on the eastern seaboard and in South America, and practicing using them as a single combat unit and practicing fleet maneuvers with them. So, you know, this is one point where I kind of point out, all right, we've got these ships that we've built for sort of one naval strategy. That's fine, but what does the operational record say? And when you get into the operational record, we see naval officers that are utilizing this ship with clearly something else in mind.
Now, is anybody in authority back in the United States concerned that this officer and the Navy are out there practicing for something bigger than just conducting independent cruiser warfare, or do they turn a blind eye to it, smile, and continue on making money and having prosperity in the 1880s?
I would say that the latter is probably more accurate. I've come across very little, not that I was really searching for it in the research that I was doing, but I've come across very little opposition to the White Squadron. Now, people didn't like Walker. Walker was kind of imperious, and he was very what's the word that I'm looking for? He knew how to get his own way. That's one of the reasons he gets appointed to the Squadron of Evolution, and one of the reasons the Squadron of Evolution even gets constituted in the first place is because what Walker really wanted was command of the North Atlantic Squadron, but he got edged out for that, so he had to create something else for himself. So certain newspapers didn't really care for him, and a large portion of the Navy didn't really care for him. But as far as the idea of the ships being together and driving around, you see some sniping in the papers about how much money that's costing, particularly when they pull into ports and have parties and that sort of thing. People gripe about that. But I wouldn't say so much that you would think that public opinion was running against them.
Okay, and let's also say that one of the best ways to not get fired is not be around, and taking the squadron to Europe and other places out of sight, out of mind for Commodore Walker. Now, let's talk for a minute. Let's just take a small side trip here and provide a little context to the times, because as we sit here today, people are used to revolutionary things showing up at Best Buy every month. I mean, new stuff, new ideas, new capabilities. We see this and expect it today. And yet, back in the 1880s, it was not dissimilar in terms of the technologies that were showing up very, very rapidly and very, very, and maturing very quickly, correct?
Right.
What kinds of things were the new technologies, the new stuff, and the new ideas of the 1880s and 1890s, this period we're headed into?
Well, one of the first things I would say about this subject is that there's tons of innovation going on, and it's all going on in Europe, because those folks, of course, are always busy shooting at each other. So post-Civil War, we over here, with the buffer of the Atlantic Ocean between us and Europe, don't really have the sort of national security problems that they have. And so there's a hotbed of development over there, and we're kind of watching. The naval files are full of reports from observers that we send over there. Hey, go look at how they're building, you know, engines, or go look at this, or go look at that, and then they report back. But we're just kind of keeping an eye on all this stuff. We're not really spending the money, which is, in some ways, is a good news story for us, because we're not spending the money on it. We're benefiting off all of the technology development that the Europeans are very busy doing. But what sorts of things are being developed at the time? Well, I would point at two big ones. The first one, I would talk about naval gunnery and armor, and the simultaneous sort of teeter-totter relationship between those two things. As gunnery gets better, we develop thicker armor and lighter armor that can withstand, you can put more of it on a ship and this kind of thing. And then as armor gets better, we develop better shells that have armor penetrating capabilities, and so on and so forth. In the late 19th century, the teeter-totter is actually teetering towards armor. All right, so we don't have, I would say, by the way, that the results of the Spanish-American War play this out, right? Because I think people are familiar with the fact that the hit rate for the American ships, even though they win, is like 0.6%. I mean, we fire thousands of shells, and you know, a few hundred find their mark. What we haven't developed yet is gunfire control.
There's the whole firepower and fire control versus protection fight that we continue to play out to this day.
Yes. So that's an issue. And then I would say, so then the problem becomes, the military problem then becomes, well, all right, if we're not entirely certain that we can actually put a hole in them above sides, above water, what if we put a hole in them underneath water where there's no armor? And everybody goes, oh, that's a great idea. And this is where we get torpedoes.
And people forget, real torpedoes existed that early.
Right. The first Whitehead torpedoes that are developed in England, and they are certainly operable by the mid-1880s. The United States develops a torpedo school at Newport, Rhode Island, where we're sort of studying all this stuff. We just haven't exactly figured out how to incorporate it. Now, torpedoes, without going off on a half an hour tangent, torpedoes bring a whole slew of problems in and of themselves. Because now you've got the ability to fire some sort of weapon at a formation, and we're going to have to do something to evade that weapon. So that means fleet maneuvers, that means signaling, that means I've got to take all my ships and put them someplace where they're not being threatened by this, by a wake of torpedoes coming at them. The other
it
thing
drives
it means,
all sorts of technology, tactics, and doctrine that
absolutely.
Wouldn't have been driven otherwise.
Absolutely. And, you know, the other thing that it means is that what if we took these torpedoes and stuck them on a little motorboat instead of on a billion-dollar capital ship? What would that look like? And so now we have the whole defense problem of we've got to think about how do you prevent attacks by torpedo boats. Well, maybe you need to develop torpedo boat destroyers, and then, of course, eventually we just refer to those as destroyers instead of torpedo boat destroyers. And so we have that whole thing going on also, which is influencing tactical development. I have to say that there is a historian by the name of Kate Epstein that is doing absolutely fantastic work on just this, and she's got a book out about the development of the torpedo that if you find the stuff I'm talking about right now interesting, that's the book.
Do me a favor and send me a note with how to contact her, because her work sounds fascinating. You're not the first person who told me about her. Now,
mm-hmm.
These technologies obviously represent as part of the revolution in naval warfare of that period. And when we come back from our network break, we're going to talk about the other side of it, the part that your book covers about the societal and intellectual side of building a Navy, okay?
Great.
And to our listeners, we'll be back in just a minute after these network messages.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Right Stream and hashtag Right Stream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network.
Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network, tune in to host Daria Ann for Right Stream Tuesday. Daria Ann interviews talented authors in a variety of literary genres, from urban fantasy and historical romance to autobiography and science fiction. Right Stream Tuesday celebrates the creativity that flows through every author. It also delves into the all-important publishing and marketing aspects of writing, including the benefits and pitfalls of independent publishing versus traditional publishing, and how to effectively use social media for success. Right Stream Tuesday with Daria Ann. Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Right Stream Radio Network.
Hi, this is Lisa Tarvis. I'm a metaphysician, board-certified holistic health practitioner, energy healer, intuitive, and the author of the book, Just Believe. I'm also a host on the Right Stream Network. My radio show is called Just Believe and airs every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Please stop by my website at www.lisatarvis.com. That's LISATARVES. For details on all the services I offer, information on my book, and my radio show. There are many amazing guests and fascinating topics scheduled for the show in the upcoming months. I look forward to connecting with you soon.
In a moment, cancer changed our lives forever.
We were told nothing could be done to enjoy these final moments together.
But in that moment, when all seemed lost, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital gave us hope.
Because at this moment, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is saving lives with pioneering research and care. We're changing the way the world treats childhood cancer by sharing our discoveries with doctors and scientists everywhere.
And
I will never have to pay St. Jude for anything, ever.
At this moment, she wants to be in her own bed.
I want to be back at school with my friends.
I want to be outside playing. Please take a moment and join St. Jude in finding cures and saving children. Visit stjude.org.
These are the sounds of someone taking their eyes off the road. Texting while driving is more than distracting. It's dangerous. Do us all a favor. When you're on the road, stay off the phone. A message from CTIA, America's Wireless Companies, and the National Safety Council.
And welcome back to Military Monday. I am your host, John Gresham, and we're talking with Commander James Renfro today about his book, Home Squadron, recently put out by U.S. Naval Institute Press. Are you there still with us, Chris?
Loud and clear.
Okay, now comes the part where you get to shamelessly plug yourself and your and what you actually wanted to talk about during this show, and that is the question of fleet development. Now, as we know, you know, we see a lot on social media these days from the U.S. Navy with the term platforms matter. And I don't question the number of platforms, the capability of platforms matter. And there are other writers who have spent an extensive amount of white space talking about the platform and weapon systems development of that period. But let's face it, you don't build a fleet just with stuff and things. You have to have men and ideas and doctrine to go ahead and make them effective. Talk to us about this period, probably up to just prior to the Spanish-American War, where the U.S. Navy develops finally as a fleet, as we would recognize one today.
Right, exactly. So, you know, I always tell people the subtitle of my book could be, you know, we have all these new ships but don't know what to do with them. And that is essentially what I'm writing about. And I think one of the developments that you can trace over time between the 1870s and the 1890s is this development of an identity of the squadron as a combat unit comprised of all of these different ships. Now, if we go back to the 1870s and the cruising navy, you had a North Atlantic squadron, and the North Atlantic squadron is the one that I specifically write about in my book rather than like the whole navy. You had a North Atlantic squadron, but it was really an administrative unit. You had an admiral who was in charge, and that admiral's job was to keep track of his ships as he sent them off to deal with various hotspots. And so here is one of the things that I sort of uncover in my book is this constant tension between, it's interesting, I was just reading some stuff in this on the op-ed page today about, you know, tension between state and defense and what you know, what missions each wants the other to carry out, right? So here we are in the 1870s, and state has this idea that these ships exist so that they can be dispatched in onesies and twosies to take care of hot spots as the Department of State sees that these, you know, come up. You know, send a ship to Haiti, send a ship to Panama, send a ship wherever. And these are all sort of administratively under the leadership of this rear admiral who doesn't actually spend any time with the squadron as a whole in the way that we would think of it. So fast
amazing
forward to the Spanish.
How throughout the centuries, the missions don't change substantially, do they?
Mm-hmm.
And
right. Go ahead.
I mean, I'm going to let you go off on this tangent because it's your book, but I'm sitting here saying, okay, maybe we ought to be reading a few books about the 1800s or the 1700s, because whether it's the Royal Navy during its heyday or the United States Navy as it began to flex itself and grow big shoulders, we're all doing the same stuff, even today.
Right. So as we begin to add these new ships to our fleet, And as we begin to try to concentrate them in more of one place at the same time, then this tension starts to become, well, you know, the Navy saying, turning around and saying to the government, well, okay, you're giving us these nice new steel ships. You supposedly want us to have some sort of capability with these ships. So in order to do this, we need to all kind of stay together and exercise. We have to actually go to sea, and we've got to go through these maneuvers over and over and over again until they become muscle memory that we could do in the event of fleet combat, right? So what sorts of things does this require? Well, it requires us keeping all of our ships together and moving them around from port to port. It requires us to have the sorts of facilities where we can pull a half dozen or eight ships in and park them and have enough coal for all of them, have enough fresh vegetables for all of them, you know, so on and so forth, right? You know, these aren't things that have existed up until now. And so a lot of my book is the, hey, where do you buy coal for six ships? Well, we don't know. We're going to have to come up with some sort of capability, some sort of a logistics train to make this happen. But at the same time,
what we would call today infrastructure.
Exactly. At the same time, we've got the Department of State saying, well, no, you've got all these nice new ships. I've got this problem in Panama. They're not running the train across the isthmus. Hey, this is costing big bucks. Get someone down there to Aspinwall and get the train running again across Panama. Or go to Haiti. They're having another revolution. Go and you get all this correspondence from the Admiral going, now, wait a minute. And we go through a series of a few admirals during this time, but the correspondence looks strikingly the same. You know, now wait a minute, I'm trying to do this, that, and the other thing, and Department of State is saying, hey, I need ships, and which is it going to be? And so there's a lot of that tension in my book as everybody together sort of wanders through this problem and tries to kind of figure it out.
It must have been fascinating as you went through it, reading everything from proposals for resupply and logistics to building the concept of giving the order of land the landing force.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, these are all maritime projection missions, and we're learning to do them again for the third time now as a Navy, but we're learning to do it on an institutional basis for a change.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So what other things is the Navy doing? Because as you pointed out the other day, the Navy is people, and people tend to build social groups. What kind of a social society did the Navy become, and what kind of a culture did they have?
Well, I knew I was getting towards the end of my story when I started seeing in the newspapers, in the New York newspapers, articles about how the North Atlantic Squadron Bicycling Club had had an outing, and the North Atlantic Squadron baseball team had taken on so-and-so and had won their baseball game. And this is the kind of markers where you go, aha, we're built. It's not just now teams. Ever since they invented baseball in the 1870s, ships had baseball teams. But here we've got the North Atlantic Squadron has one that is comprised of these different ships. That tells me they're spending enough time together that they can get together and play baseball. So you're really starting to see the development of this ethos, this esprit de corps, as a combat unit that didn't exist 20 years previous to that.
And correct me if I'm wrong, the public is starting to be proud of their Navy. They're taking an interest in their Navy as they read about it, as they hear about it, as they see the ships come into port.
Absolutely. Certain admirals are better at this than others. I would say that probably exhibit A of being really good at it is John Grimes Walker, who never met a newspaperman he didn't like.
my kind of guy.
He would take that Squadron Revolution and he'd run up and down the East Coast and he'd pull into Boston and he'd pull into New York and he'd pull into these various places. He always opened the ships up to the public, and you would get places. By the time you get into the late 1880s and early 1890s, I spent so much time going through And I mean, I went through every single piece of this stuff. I spent so much time going through telegrams from little cities that would want ships to pull in. Hey, you know, the citizens of, you know, whatever podunk coastal town would love it if, you know, a ship would come in, and then they'd run special trains. Hey, the Navy is here, and we're running specials to come from, you know, the hinterland to come into town to see the Navy. And so, yeah, it's certainly there's a whole PR aspect there. And I've actually...
Not unlike what's going to be happening in a couple of weeks, God willing, with the Andrews Air Show, the Joint Services Air Show here at Andrews Air Force Base. And in fact, it is air show season around the country.
Yes. Oh, that I had forgotten about that. I used to work at Andrews Air Force Base, and I tell you, it was a good time to take off when they were having that air show.
You just didn't want a 500,000 people coming in and treading all over your turf, man.
Exactly. Exactly.
But in terms of public support, this really does rationalize the services, the Navy in this case, in the minds of a public which is beginning to think for a change outside of their own borders, aren't they?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Now, without going into a great big discussion about the ships of the time, how about a teeny-weeny little discussion about what were some of the wonderful ships that the United States was building by this turn of the decade, the late 1880s and the early 1890s?
Well, we get our first two what you could call battleships were authorized in 1886. So by the ABCD ships, as I told you, were strictly cruising ships. The first ships that are armored actually would have some sort of capability to withstand attack from a peer naval competitor are the Texas and the Maine. And they're authorized 1886, I think launched right around the turn of the decade there.
And we would characterize these as classic Edwardian-type battleships, correct?
Sure. And they're probably... armored cruiser is a better designation than battleship. Now, Maine eventually, before she's blown up, eventually is redesignated as a battleship, but she was originally launched as an armored cruiser. So they don't quite have – you got to remember, there's still a lot of political resistance to building a battleship, because what does that say? That says that we are seeking combat on the high seas. So when the Indiana class comes out in 1994 – the three ships of the Indiana class are our first true actual battleships, but they still, you might have heard of them being referred to as seagoing coastal battleships. That's the language that's written into the legislation. And it's written into the legislation on purpose to make sure that everyone who's reading the piece of legislation knows that they don't actually have the range in their coal bunkers to go very far away from the coast, because they are intended to be, you know, coastal defense battleships. Nonetheless,
of course, the first war that we choose to get involved with is 90 miles off the coast of America.
Yeah, exactly. And then they
Funny
do quite
that.
Well down there.
Now, you talk about this. These are obviously baby steps.
Mm-hmm.
But America, as you were just pointing out, America loves its Navy right now. It likes its Navy. And on top of which, let's move to sort of the context of, you've talked about a period where the United States Navy has grown not just in size, but in capability and in intellect, in societal terms, in cultural terms, in all sorts of ways as a force. It is no. Explain the difference between the fleet of 1874 and the fleet of 1898. You're talking about a quarter century of difference there. What are the major points you would make about the differences between the fleets of those two times?
Well, one of the examples that I use in my book, if to contextualize sort of the difference between the mindset of these two organizations, let's talk about what happens when the Maine blows up. So the Maine blows up in Havana Harbor, February 1898, and word gets back to Key West that night. Now, the North Atlantic Squadron happens to be in Key West because they're down there doing exercises, which was something that by the time we reach 1898, something that they're actually doing fairly frequently. And so... If you think what might have happened in 1874, Well, what might have happened was they might have gotten underway and just steamed to Havana and started shelling the place, because this was the sort of mindset that independent captains had. I'm going to take action based on this information that I have, and I don't have time to get any word from higher authority. But what does the North Atlantic Squadron do? Admiral Sicard actually moves the ships in closer to Key West. They were actually out kind of at the Dry Tortugas. They were a little ways away. He moves in closer, sends a boat ashore to get to the telegraph, and sits by the telegraph waiting for instructions from the Navy Department. So here we have this development of the conceptualization of the squadron as an instrument of power in the way that we would think about it today, ready for the Department of the Navy to say, go forth and execute this strategy, as opposed to a bunch of captains just sort of making it up on the fly. And I think that vignette says a lot about how the squadron thinks of itself, how its commander-in-chief thinks of it, and how the Department of the Navy thinks of the squadron.
And, of course, embedded in what you just said is a technological fact, which is there has suddenly been developed an instantaneous long-range communication medium in the form of the telegraph.
Right, which is more prevalent. Now, we've got the telegraph in the 1870s, but certainly we have a whole bunch more of it by 1898. So it is a lot of communication is done by telegraph.
And it's not just Key West, which is communicating with the Department of the Navy. Way, way out on the other side of the world, there's a guy by the name of George Dewey, who also has a telegraph.
Right, exactly.
Explain what he does.
Well, the interesting thing about Dewey, now, when you teach this to midshipmen, they're all familiar with George Dewey, because they get that sort of rammed down their throat here at the Naval Academy. But the thing that I spend more time in class on is not so much the Battle of Manila Bay, which certainly is important, and obviously he destroys the Spanish fleet, which it's really a little bit more like target practice than it is an actual battle, and that's all fine. But what makes the story is that everything that Dewey does in the months preceding up to that, because here is a guy, again, in the absence of doctrine, right? So we're doing all this for the first time. There is no manual that you can go to and say, if you are overseas in Hong Kong, you'll do the following things to prepare for combat. I mean, none of this exists. Dewey's making it up.
You obviously have a couple of talented admirals on the operational end of those telegraphs. And who is on the Washington, D.C. end of that telegraph? Because there's a name that I'm going to coax out of you right here.
Or we wouldn't be talking about Theodore Roosevelt, would we?
Oh, just possibly. Roosevelt and how he emerges from this time of revolution that you've just had over the past quarter century.
Well, I don't know, I won't want to call it a fun fact, but the interesting thing about Theodore Roosevelt is, of course, the name on all these telegrams is his boss's name, Secretary of the Navy Long. And Secretary of the Navy Long is certainly supportive of Roosevelt to a point, but he is not nearly as in favor of taking an aggressive stance as Roosevelt is. And Long is also not a particularly healthy guy. And so he has a tendency to like to go home to his home in Vermont and kind of, hang out, especially during the summer. And the very famous story of Dewey in Hong Kong goes something like, Secretary of the Navy Long had a headache and went home at lunch one afternoon to recuperate at home. And meanwhile, Assistant Secretary of the Navy Roosevelt essentially got the entire U.S. Navy on a war footing while the secretary was at home recovering from his headache. But so, yes, Theodore Roosevelt is certainly leaning a lot further forward than his boss is.
And he's doing so having been energized by a book, which I'm afraid any discussion of this period cannot go without, which is a little thing called The Influence of Sea Power Upon History.
Right, and good old ATM, as I refer to him to my students when I'm lecturing. I have a certain like for good old Alfred Thayer, who was a guy who had a moderately successful series of tours at sea, but found that what he was really better at doing was giving lectures and writing, so came ashore. So he sounds, you know, not unlike someone that that I know, although a lot more famous. But you know, the thing that I think is really important to point out is that everything in my book is taking place, and I'm not the first historian to get on this. I mean, there are certainly are others. But everything in my book is taking place at least a decade prior to Mahan's book coming out. So we spent an awful lot of time talking about the influence of sea power upon history, which hits the presses in 1890. What that does is it actually publicizes and puts a face on all this stuff that's been going on in my book from 1874 to 1890. And Mahan just lays it out in front of the general public and says, hey, isn't this a great idea? And fortunately, the general public says, yeah, this is a great idea.
So, to kind of put this to bed, what of course results is what became known as the Splendid Little War, the Spanish-American War of 1898. And to a great degree, because of the things that you describe in your book that had happened decades earlier, basically, the United States Navy eats the Spanish Navy for lunch and spits it out. I mean, is that a
right.
fair statement?
It's a fair statement. Now, there's an awful lot of context to saying that, but in general, yes. And I would say that it's almost unfortunate for folks like me who, of course, are very excited by tactics and the development of operational doctrine and all these other things that I'm working on. And so you arrive at the War of 1898, and you go, okay, well, let's see all this stuff in action. And the results, frankly, aren't nearly as exciting as you would wish they would be. We already talked about Manila Bay. Now the good news is that Dewey's ships are actually in formation. They form a column formation. Dewey flies the signal, follow the movements of the flagship. So they all follow the movements of the flagship. And that pretty much is, the other than open fire and then cease firing, those are the three signals that Dewey flies. So not too much for me there as a tactician, other than everything that went into that fight to prepare for it, which I would maintain is the more important story. Now, to go to the other side of the world and talk about Santiago de Cuba, we know how that battle unfolds. The Spanish attempt to make their escape from Santiago, and Commodore Schley, who sees them coming out, goes, oh, my God, here come the Spanish. And he flies a flag that says engage, something along the lines of engage the enemy more closely, or general chase, or something like that. And that's literally the only signal that gets flown during the entire engagement. And all of the U.S. ships get up steam, and everybody just flies after the Spanish as fast as they can. I might add, nearly colliding, causing at least two very near collisions between U.S. battleships. And there's almost nothing to be learned tactically from that engagement either. So, again, I would say the story is more everything that happened prior to the engagement itself.
But the point being that this thing that you have talked about, this revolution in U.S. naval affairs, leads to, obviously, a victory, the acquisition
yes.
of something of an empire, and America suddenly realizing they've got a fairly badass little navy.
Mm-hmm. That's fair.
Which raises the question, what do they do in the next few years? I mean, obviously the big things that happen, of course, are Roosevelt, through another assassination, winds up becoming president and digs a big ditch through Central America.
Right.
Which we call the Panama Canal. But what happens to that fleet over the next decade or so after
well, here's what I tell my students. I say, okay, let's go look out the window. Everybody go look out the window. So we look out the window. I say, you see all these buildings, the older ones, not our newer-looking buildings that look like they were built in the 70s and 80s, but our older-looking buildings. And everybody says, yeah. I say, guess when those were all built? They're supposed to know because they're supposed to get taught this when they're plebes, but, you know, essentially they're all built around 1900 and 1904. Guess what? This is a result, essentially, of the Spanish-American War. So what am I saying with this example is that the money spigots open up wide open. There is more money than the Navy can possibly shake a stick at. The brand-new buildings for the Naval Academy is one example. There are many, many others across the board. And so by 1916, we get as the preparedness movement for the First World War is ramping up, we get the declaration that we are going to have a Navy, quote-unquote, second to none. What does that mean? That means that we plan to even be larger than the Royal Navy, which we had always sort of accepted a second-class status to. So, and certainly you can point at the Spanish-American War as kind of opening those floodgates.
Chris, you've told a really great story here that most Americans probably wouldn't be aware of. And, of course, the obvious context to our current situation with current present-day U.S. Navy, I think, is fairly obvious to people who track such things. Let's go back, though, to your story with this book. You obviously finished up your graduate work and had your thesis. Your graduate advisor clearly thought well enough of it to let you go ahead and graduate with your degree. What was the process between your graduate thesis being approved and U.S. Naval Institute Press going ahead and deciding they wanted to make a book out of it?
Well, I had to, like most authors, I had to, and this, by the way, my absolute first time doing this, so it was all a learning experience for me. But you have to decide what's really important, right? The thesis came in at 140,000 words, and the publisher, since I'm certainly not Tom Clancy or anyone like that, so the publisher's only going to give me so many words. So I got 100,000 words. And I had to pretty quickly...
Oh, trust me, on the books I did with them, we had a hard budget of 129,000 words. Go over that, and they start lopping them off randomly.
Yep, pretty much, just like that. So, I mean, where I'm going with this is I had to lose about 70 pages. And so I really had to sit down with the story and decide what is it I'm trying to talk about, what is just extra detail. I'm no longer trying to impress either my advisor or the board of people that approved the dissertation. So what sorts of research can I just, you know, don't need to have in there? And that process, I'd say, took probably 6 months to just, you know, sort of sit down with the various drafts and try to get it figured out. Other than that, you know, I had an easier time than most authors because I actually had a manuscript in hand, right? So once I got the cuts.
I envy you the ability to go ahead and just edit your way to your book.
Yeah, well, that's the first and only time that'll happen. I'm afraid they're all going to have to be from scratch from now.
Which raises a question. First question is, how did you like the job that U.S. Naval Institute did in packaging it and putting it out?
Oh, very pleased. I couldn't be more happy. I'm very pleased with it.
Okay, which raises the question, now that you've been baited into thinking this is a great thing to do, what's the next book you have in mind? What are you going to do next?
Well, the obvious follow-on to my work is gets us up to the First World War. As you might be familiar, the U.S. Navy sent four battleships over to join the Grand Fleet in Scapa Flow and become part of the British battle line in late 1917 and 1918. And, when they got over there, the Royal Navy was kind of like, well, we're very happy to have you Yanks here. That's great. You know, you have some deficiencies. And you can tease that stuff out if you look at the correspondence. And so I think book two is Spanish-American War to World War I. What kind of developments were we good at? What kind of developments needed some work? And I think that story ends probably in Scapa Flow with our four battleships sailing around with the Royal Navy as part of their battle line, and then, you know, see where we go into the interwar period.
So basically telling the story of how the U.S. fleet became more than just another division of the Grand Fleet.
Well, yeah, how the U.S. fleet actually became a fleet is, and again, it's one thing to have all these ships, and it's another thing to be able to effectively operate them as a battle line. And, you know, as I think we just said 5 minutes ago, I would argue that we don't ever really see the U.S. fleet operated as a battle line in combat, right, because the Spanish-American War doesn't show us that. So You know, as we continue to develop that capability in the early 20th century, what does that look like?
Very good. And with that, Chris, I'm going to call an end to this and let you get back to helping those fertile young minds learn about how to be ossifers. Anyway, I want to thank you very much for coming on and telling your story and the story of your book. And I hope when you finish up the next one, you come back on.
Super. Well, I would be glad to. And I've had a great time. I appreciate it.
Chris, thank you so much. Have a great day and a great week. Take care.
Thank you. Same to you. Bye-bye.
And with that, we come to the end of another edition of Military Monday. But I think you're going to enjoy what we've got for you in the next few weeks. It is that time of year when those of us who love the title of naval historian begin to go and think a lot about America's greatest naval victory, that being the Battle of Midway. And to that end, we're going to start having a series of shows that I think you're going to enjoy about aspects of Midway and the Great Pacific War. We're looking at the 72nd anniversary of Midway, the 70th anniversary of the Marianas Campaign, and we're going to start giving you shows starting next week. And we're going to begin with folks from the Naval War College up in Newport, Rhode Island, talking about the incredible preservation and curation effort they've done with something called the Nimitz Gray Book, essentially the daily log of Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet, Chester Nimitz. I hope that you come back with us again and join us next Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern for the next edition of Military Monday.
I took a flat to a pawn shop for a broken guitar. I took a flat to a pawn shop. How much is that guitar? I took a flat to a pawn shop. I got me that guitar. What's a flat in a pawn shop to me? Saw a man on the TV in a mask with a gun. A man on the TV, he had a 10-year-old son. I saw a man on the TV, his son had a gun. I wrote a song for a dead man to settle my soul. A song for a dead man, and now I'll never grow old. I wrote a song for a dead man, and now I'm out in the cold. What's the song? Make up your mind. There's a baby on the doorstep, longing for the day. There's a baby on the doorstep, who gives his life to take. A flag to a pawn shop, a flag to a pawn shop. May he forget why he is crying so dear.